This podcast is sponsored by the Center for International Business, Loyola University New Orleans College of Business.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Gumbo of Opportunities podcast. I am your host, Farrah Wells, Program Coordinator for the Center for International Business, and I am joined by research postdoc scholar Dr. Alessandro Braga and full international business professor, as well as the director for the Center for International Business at Loyola University New Orleans, Dr. Gustavo Barbosa. And we are here to talk all things the hot topics of international business right now, which is knowledge spillover effects and foreign direct investments, specifically experiences of Costa Rica.
Welcome to Gumbo of Opportunities, the podcast where we dive deep into the landscape of international business with a closer look at the state of Louisiana and New Orleans. We will hear stories, insights, and strategies of influential global players of the Bayou region in a pursuit to make the Bayou one of the most attractive areas for businesses. This is Gumbo of Opportunities.
So, let's dive right into it. All right, the first question, Dr. Barbosa, let's kick us off with what are knowledge spillover effects and why is it so important to talk about it when discussing international business?
Thank you so much, Farrah. This is a great opportunity to talk about a topic that has been in the scholarly agenda for, you know, give or take 100 years, and it has been growing exponentially since right around the 1995, give or take. So just a little bit of history here is going to be important. One of the topics that economists and policymakers have been trying to understand for the longest time is that of economic growth and how that economic growth then moves from large units of aggregation, namely countries, into smaller units of aggregation, regions, and within regions, then industries, and within industries, firms. And it's a process that, because of its complexity, was initially officially kicked out by a scholar named Robert Solow in the 1950s, where he wrote a paper that was, it's a pioneer paper that explains that economic growth is the result of mainly resources accumulation and out of that, there is a proportion that is important that is called technology, and that technology was assumed to be exogenous, that is, manna from heaven. It just came out of somewhere, and somehow that explains the process of growth. The process then was pushed forward in the 1960s by Kenneth Arrow, another recipient of the Nobel Prize, where Kenneth Arrow talks about these specific issues of endogenous, the possibility of endogenous growth, that is, technology may grow from within. That still leaves out some of the questions, you know, how, by whom, and why. In the 1990s, another scholar by name Robert Solow comes out with a groundbreaking piece of work on a paper that is called Endogenous Growth. And Robert Solow says that this technology is actually knowledge, and that knowledge is created within the firms. And that because of that, that knowledge that is created in one place could then be, you know, absorbed, used by others. It could spill over. And yet, it leaves some of that, unexplained. And then in the 1995, David Aldrich, of whom we're going to hear in some of the podcasts that we've been blessed that he, you know, participated in the conference in Costa Rica that we're going to talk a little bit more about later. And Zlatan Ax, they work on something known as the knowledge spillover theory of entrepreneurship. And so they put now the cherry on entrepreneurship. And they argue that is this entrepreneur, type of a Schumpeterian entrepreneur, the person that commercializes the idea, either because they sell it to somebody else or they're able to take it to market, creates that possibility for the spillover to take place. So what is a spillover? So a spillover is something that happens unintendedly. It's an externality, positive, that someone benefits from something that somebody else did. And that process of spilling over then creates all this new field of research that tries to understand what can spill over, why does it spill over, do spillovers decay in terms of distance and location? Do spillovers, you know, happen across the same industry or across different industries? And so when we talk about the concept of spillover, it's something that happens in one place but has effects elsewhere. And they are highly related to the assumption of knowledge. Now, knowledge is it's a function of individuals thinking about something. Sometimes it's a serendipity, you know, moment. Something just boom occurs, right? Like a light bulb goes off, and you're like, "Oh, I have an idea." Sometimes a person says something, and the recipient hears something different and says, "Oh, I can use this doing X, Y, Z." Sometimes it's the result of an observation, something that everybody has seen but no one has really observed. Like, you know, Newton talks about gravity by looking at an apple going down, but everybody has seen apples going down for millions of years, right? At least 100,000 years, but no one has really questioned why. And so the spillover that could happen in any sort of interrelationship, in this case, goes specifically to someone possessing knowledge of superior quality that still has the capability to be commercialized yet again. If the knowledge has already fully been commercialized, it cannot spill over because there is no more value to be created. And so I know this is a long answer, but it's a complicated concept, one that I have been working for 20 years, give or take, in my career trying to explain it. And luckily, in the last couple of years, make a significant amount of work, growth on this, specifically as we go into international business because of its connectivity with international trade, and trade being the mechanism by which this knowledge may transfer from one location to another location. Now, when we look into international business, in our previous, you know, first podcast, we talk about the importance of the figure of foreign direct investment, multinationals moving knowledge from one place to another place. We tend to assume that multinationals are going to do it because one or two reasons. One, they move to another country because it's cheaper. That's what we call the low-cost strategy. But we also can think of multinationals moving to another location because there are superior resources there that could be enhanced if they encounter superior technology. And so from the perspective of international business, the recipient country benefits if the investment that comes through is of superior quality, that is technology that is advanced, and here we can dive deeper, right? But if it is superior, then it has this potentiality to spill over into the domestic production. And this is what this podcast today is going to be about. I know it's a mouthful answer, but it is a concept that is, let me put it this way. Once you start thinking about it, it's very hard to stop to think about something else.
No, I think that was a wonderful answer and definitely sets the tone for the rest of the information to come on this podcast. And so, Dr. Braga, I would love to bring the second question to you, which is, what about foreign direct investments? And so what is, if you could explain to the audience the definition as well as why are so many countries trying to be attractive to foreign countries, businesses, and governments in relation to this topic?
Of course. So let's start by saying that we can have a very, very easy definition of foreign direct investing, a very generic definition that can be really stuck in our brain. Which means dealing in foreign direct investment means having a business that decides to invest money, infrastructure, development of a product, the setting of a research and development laboratory in a foreign country. That is, I guess, the easiest definition that we can provide for foreign direct investment. If we look at the United States scenario, we find a very interesting definition that is brought to us by the U.S. Department of Commerce, which defines FDI as whenever a U.S. citizen, so a private individual or an organization or an affiliated group who takes an interest of 10% or more in a foreign business entity. Now, this interest, how can we materialize in concrete terms this interest? It can be a joint venture. It should be like the setting up the development of a subsidiaries. So we have many examples of making this definition more visible, more concrete to us, if we need then to fully understand the powerful of the process that we are that is occurring today in our world of huge amount of inward and outward FDI that are occurring everywhere. Those examples can be just on top of my head. The first example could be Tesla. Tesla is one of the most prominent companies today, one of the most innovative ones, especially in the automotive industry. Tesla, for example, opened up a subsidiary recently in China. I have other examples that sometimes I use for classes like, staying on the automotive industry. Also, we have European automotive companies like BMW. Looking for opportunities, for example, in Southern Asia, like, for example, in China, for example, in Singapore, in particular, looking for where the knowledge is. So you need to invest in putting, more technology and technology in cars now. Cars now, I don't know the exact percentage, but are probably more technologically driven than mechanical driven. So far, you cannot even now send your car to a standard repair shop now, because if you have an issue on the electrical and technical part, or on the auto driven part of your car, a standard repair shop cannot deal with your problem. You have to go to the official repair shop of your automotive brand. That tells us how much any product everywhere in the world has filled with innovations, has filled with specific components that are created anywhere in the world. In particular, that reminds me of an important concept that we have today of global products, which means products in which we can see really that components that make that product, that good functioning, working, are made maybe in different parts of the world. A microchip made in Singapore. The example of the Boeing, in which, for example, if you think about a Boeing airplane, in which we have components of the plane made in Japan, we have then the doors of the plane, of the same plane made in Singapore, we have the wing flaps of the Boeing 737 made by an Italian company. That really gives us a more visual representation of what global products are and how much that is a direct effect of this huge inward and outward flux of foreign direct investment. I'm sure I'm going to look at it later, but when we will start talking about the case of Costa Rica and what happened in Costa Rica more than a couple of months ago, but still in 2024. But what happens now is that countries and businesses are really looking everywhere in terms of thinking what can be the best location for making a specific component for a product or for placing a specific service. Earlier, we were thinking about companies looking for friends. What Dr. Barbosa discussed in a previous episode about the friends shoring, right? That component is not disappeared, but now it's not just friends shoring. It's really looking for business opportunities everywhere in the world. And the idea of having these trading barriers falling down pieces by pieces, now the world is really interconnected. The business are interconnected. And therefore, it's not just about looking for friends now, it's just looking for who can be the best for making a specific product, who can be the best for providing a specific service, so that not everyone can produce everything, but just really looking at in which direction we can find the best partner, the best commercial partner, to find the most quality in a specific component, to find the most exceptional performance for producing, for manufacturing a specific product. So it's about saying foreign direct investments do not follow a linear pathway now. We don't see that much foreign direct investment that starts from developed countries towards other developed countries. Again, foreign direct investment from developed countries going towards developing countries. Dr. Barboso will talk about later about the very interesting case of Costa Rica in this sense. Despite there is still a debate ongoing if whether Costa Rica can be still defined as developing countries or not, but that's another, maybe that will be another episode for that. Today we see also foreign direct investment flux going from developing countries towards other developing countries. If you think about it, why shouldn't countries that are trying to emerge in the global markets, trying to play a huge part in global businesses, why shouldn't they look for same opportunities as much as like businesses in the Western world have done for decades in developing countries, right? So I guess that starting from that very, very easy and generic definition of foreign direct investment, there is literally a word in it that can really inspire us of really looking for what the world, what specific countries can offer, what can specific countries can develop better than other, even better than established Western world democratized countries.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think both of these definitions are essential to this episode to really understand these key topics that are in the international business industry and as well as areas of you your expertise. And so I want to now talk about really zooming into what we've mentioned before as the case of Costa Rica. We have the pleasure of having a native Costa Rican with us. Dr. Barboso is born and raised in Costa Rica, and he had the pleasure of leading a conference in his home country. So in the spring, we had the opportunity to represent Loyola New Orleans College of Business in San Jose, and we brought the series of conferences called Creative Sparks Emerging Markets, and we had the pleasure of discussing the case of Costa Rica. First of all, can you explain, Dr. Barboso, what is this series of conferences that is Creative Sparks? Why did you choose to bring this conference to Costa Rica? And then we can talk about some of the highlights of your time while you were there.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. As you said, born and raised in Costa Rica. We spoke about this in the first podcast. We also talk about in the first podcast of the importance of networks in connecting with people. And Alessandro spoke about the benefits of LinkedIn as a professional network. And I have to say, when I first moved to Loyola, I had an embedded interest, and part of the mandate of my chair was to expand the presence of international business programs in representation of Loyola. And naturally, you know, we start looking to the south. Being from Costa Rica, I have quite a few connections still, even though I left 30 years or so ago, but I, go back and forth regularly, with the family. And I kept in contact with a lot of people. So we started developing partnerships. And out of those partnerships, we developed one with a coalition that is called SIND in Spanish, is the Foreign Direct Investment Attraction Office. It's a non-for-profit organization that enhances It was created sometime during the 1990s to promote the attraction of foreign direct investment in Costa Rica. So that's one piece of the puzzle. The second piece of the puzzle was, as part of this outreach through LinkedIn, I was able to connect with Professor Aldrich out of the IU Bloomington. Professor Aldrich has been a champion in supporting our efforts. And we invited him a couple times to Loyola. Once during pandemic, he couldn't come, but then he came and also gave us opportunity to be the keynote speaker at a conference that we organized and start developing this relationship. As part of that relationship and as part of the challenges that life brings, an opportunity opened up at the College of Business to hire a new replacement faculty. And so David was essentially suggesting a couple of names, of which we, of course, reached out to the person, and a full search process went, and we were lucky to attract one of our faculty that I would like to invite him for one of these podcasts, Professor Belitsky, Maxim Belitsky. Max is a force to reckon with. He is, outstanding researcher. I mean, a really, really world-class researcher. And Max and David have started this creative sparks back in Bolzano, Italy, time ago, and moved it to Germany. And because of that, and the two forces, came together. I spoke with Max, we're doing this, we want to invite you and David and a group of researchers, Christina Teodoraki, and then invite other people, Bill Newberry from Florida International, and then local representatives in Costa Rica to do this conference that is going to help us understand the data that we have gotten from CINDE and the Promotora of Comercio of Costa Rica on foreign direct investment. And they said, we're on. And so we start looking for a name, and we said, what if, we give a spin to the Creative Sparks that has typically been a think tank for research on the topics, but mainly for the, advanced developed economies. What if we call it Emerging Markets Costa Rica? And that's where the name came from, and that's how the conference, came to be. And so we decided, in partnership with La Academia de Centroamérica, which is a think tank in Costa Rica, CINDE, COMEX and Promotora de Comercio, which is the Ministry of Trade and the promotion agency that seals any business that is engaging in the exporting, and then the Foreign Attraction Agency, CINDE, plus the University of Costa Rica, my alma mater, that's where I got my degree, and was my first job as a professor in Costa Rica back in the day. And then, of course, connections. Networking matters tremendously. The rector of the university, the president, is a good friend of mine, and he gave us all the support. And because of that, we were able to put together this, great conference. Once again, thank you so much to the Reynolds Chair and Pam and Bill Ryan for their support in providing the financial resources for this to happen. So we conducted this conference, and the conference has the interest to look into emerging markets. Now, that's my baby. That's my bias, right? I do work in developed economies as well, but I have this knack for emerging markets for a very simple reason. The largest world population is in emerging markets or less developed countries. The right of the human is to be happy but also have a prosperous life, and so eradicating poverty and creating opportunities for others is an essential component of what we do in economics and business, more so than just the profits that a firm can raise. And, of course, from the perspective of a Catholic university, advancing those opportunities and creating a discussion platform is an essential component of the work that we do. So Costa Rica, of course, because I know Costa Rica, I go there, I am Costa Rican, and but also because Costa Rica presents a very interesting case. It's an incredibly interesting case, a very unique country in many ways, predominantly because it doesn't have an army since 1949. It has been a democracy since 1821 consistently, so it's the longest standing democracy. It is incredibly peaceful, not crime-free, but peaceful. And it has has created an environment in which firms, even though it's a country of 5 million people, a little bit about the same size as Sweden, creates an environment with a significantly large bilingual, sometimes trilingual population with very high levels of human capital because education is free, there is no army, universal healthcare system, and other conditions, plus being a very good friend with the United States. So friendship here matters. In terms of trade, the U.S. is the number one trading partner. It is in the same latitude, same hemisphere. A flight from Costa Rica to Miami is 2 hours and 15 minutes. A flight to Chicago is about 4 hours and a half. It's incredibly simple to get access to. It's very safe. It has become the number one spot for retirees from the U.S. Moving, instead of going to Florida, go to Costa Rica. And has a history after the debacle of the 1980s, it's known as the lost decade, where everything went belly up and debt pile up and employment, inflation, you name it, we had it. Beginning of the 1990s, it started a very severe reform process, and that reform process created, because of necessity, the conditions to change the economic background of the economy. And like anything else, you know, luck plays a good important factor in it. And in the year 1993, negotiations started with a very large multinational. The name of the company is Intel. And Intel was looking for a new place to produce microchips. And back in the day, the country that offered the best conditions was Chile, because Chile has gone through a significant process of reform during the Pinochet era. It was like carrot and stick, but it was more stick than carrots. And under this, the advice of the Chicago School of Economics, which is the most, you know, pro-market liberal school in the U.S., Chile engaged in a very open market economy that created opportunities for investments. And so, you know, Intel was looking into that. But, you know, a secret like that very quickly becomes known. And Costa Rica found out that Intel was looking for a plant, to build a plant, and they, long story short, engaged in conversations. Even though Intel said that's not going to happen, they were able to convince the CEO to stop in Costa Rica, and they offered this Intel, you know, heaven on earth to build the plant. And they said, well, we'll check with Chile. Chile didn't offer anything because they were, you know, just free market economy, and then Intel signed and built a plant in Costa Rica. That plant in Costa Rica was about 5,000 engineers that they hired on the one contract. The investment that 1 year represented 5% of the GDP, and very quickly the Intel plant in Costa Rica was producing at the same level as the one in Singapore and the U.S., and it became known that Costa Rica has this capability that we did not know. Because Intel is there, it means that this is it becomes a hub, it becomes a center where other companies want to go. And so whenever you go out looking for investment and you say Intel is there, everybody's like, oh, Intel is there, I should go. And then you start naming the companies and everybody wanted to go there. Today, you know, you fast forward and you have about 640 some. Today's probably around 750 multinationals, some incredibly large. You have Boston Scientific, you have Bayer, you have Pfizer, Abbott, semiconductors. In fact, because of the CHIPS Act, Costa Rica now has become a hot spot in terms of which companies are going to go there, because the big ones are already playing there, and the U.S. government is actually investing a tremendous amount of retraining for people to produce more semiconductors. And so you observe a transformation that happens, and Costa Rica then provides this very interesting case. It's still a very small economy, but it provides something of an ecosystem that is working, and thus the conference, right, was directed to that. Outcomes that are coming out of this conference, of course, the agreements with the agencies. We are working on a few papers, a couple chapters, a few papers. We're looking into continuing the expansion. We have memorandums of understanding. We are continuing to promote the study abroads in Costa Rica that are on the international business visits to companies, of which Ali and I are going to be in charge. And so we hope that more of this will come. We hope to draw attention to emerging markets and the potentiality that they bring for companies seeking both high productive sites, maybe not the cheapest, but high productive sites, good productivity, reliability, easy access in and out, and then, of course, stability, because these tend to be much more friendly. And by friendly, I mean they tend to be on the same political side as the U.S. is, so there is an interest of the U.S. Now, you cross the Atlantic, and now what happens is Costa Rica has also become part of the OECD, which is the Organization of Economic Development and Cooperation, and is one of the first emerging economies that is part of this group. And that's a major breakthrough for a small country that now has become one of the fastest growing in terms of attraction of foreign direct investment. So we believe that there's a story to be told here. And it's a story that somewhat, despite challenges, has some success. And of course, we're diving into the data. And the more we dive, the more we find out. But it's been nothing short of a very interesting journey. And so we look forward to continuing working on this.
That's so wonderful. That's the benefit of establishing these conferences, is that the work doesn't end when the conference is over. And so
correct.
As of right now, when we're recording this episode, it's been 4 months and the work is still evolving. And, yes. You know, we in our previous episode, we talked about how evolving of a field international business is. And so to have the opportunity at Loyola to bring such experts in the field together to accomplish amazing things, that's nothing short of exciting. So thank you so much. And just a fun fact, I heard there was an earthquake the first day that the conference was held. What was that experience?
Yeah, that's correct. I think only one of us was there. Bill Newberry had arrived earlier. And the rest of us, we were on the minivan from the airport to the hotel. So, of course, with the bumpy roads. Costa Rican roads are very similar to New Orleans roads. Some are very good, some are very bad.
And when they're bad, they're bad.
Oh, yeah. No one can drive straight. And so, there was a quake. I think it was like 4.2. Costa Rica is the youngest part of America. And it's about 100 million years. No, it's about 50 million years old, something like that. It's the youngest part. In still information. And so it's a beautiful country, has nine active volcanoes, and it has two major plagues. You got to understand that the Rockies and the Andes meet in Costa Rica. And so earthquakes of the range of 3 to 4.5, they're regular, they're good. You want to have them, you know, often. But people do get a little bit scared. And I guess Bill Newberry was the one that that felt the whole thing. We didn't feel much.
Yeah, but it was probably the only one not in the van at that moment.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are just some fun stories that, you know, those are the memorable side notes of the conference when they happen. So.
But for sure, it was a welcome.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. What a way to kick off your conference. Well, thank you for that. So to bring a fresh perspective, Dr. Braga, who is originally from Italy, has never been to Costa Rica before, and he had the pleasure of attending this conference and visiting Costa Rica, specifically San Jose, for the first time. So, you know, what was your experience? And also, given what Gustavo discussed, what are your impressions of how this country is developing and becoming a world player?
Thank you for the question. Well, apart from the national welcome of the first earthquake to happen exactly like half an hour later from our landing in Costa Rica, it has been an incredible experience, an experience that I hope I will be able to replicate later in time. Costa Rica, as Gustavo clearly described earlier, is a very interesting country in a very rapid transition with the idea of becoming really a world player. Gustavo mentioned that everything basically started with the huge state reforms in the 90s. Basically, those reforms made the fertile grounds for what the country is today and probably what it's going to be like in the next decades. I refer in particular to the fact that not that long ago, so we're talking about a little bit more than 30 years ago, the economy in Costa Rica was, and I'm looking straight to Gustavo for confirmation, but it was mainly an agricultural-based economy, like you probably would expect to all these countries located in this very, very tiny outskirts compressed between the two oceans. Well, because of setting the right conditions, because of strengthening relationship with global players, like you mentioned, with the United States, that led for an ongoing process. And I said specifically ongoing, because Costa Rica is still developing as we speak, for pushing towards a more advanced economy that is not just agricultural-based, but now can literally is a global player in exporting medical devices. And when I was doing some of my researches, trying to get some more information about the country, even if, you know, you have to be there sometimes too. You can get as much information as you want, but once you're there, once you speak with people there, once you speak with entrepreneurs, academics, you really understand how the country is changing and how people are changing with it. One thing that I can mention, I want to mention here, that really opened my eyes about Costa Rica, is not just the fact, which is extremely important, that now the country is a global player for medical devices. It's the fact that also Costa Rica is a tourist destination, but not for the kind of tourism that we might expect. Not just for that, I mean, because I'm sure there are beautiful beaches that they need to have the chance to visit, but I'm sure to bring into my what-to-do list for the next trip there. But the type of tourist that someone defined to be medical tourism. So the idea that we have so many foreign visitors now that literally are included in the tourist type of economic and macroeconomic data, that just don't visit the country for its history, its historical artifacts, its beautiful museums, or for the natural wonders that Costa Rica has to offer, but in particular way to enjoy the high quality of specific medical performances. And what I was digging into it, I got very much surprised to read that about a little bit less than 15% of the tourists visiting Costa Rica go there for having some sort of a surgery. So taking advantage of the high quality that hospitals and private clinics for having, for example, hip replacement, shoulder surgeries, fertility treatments. That really doesn't sound like something that a developing country would do. That's why earlier I would say, well, maybe we should think about if either Costa Rica is still a developing country or is literally like knocking the door to the Western world, to what is defined to be the Western world. That is probably the thing that surprised me the most in my very, very short visit there.
Interesting.
Yeah. To add a little bit to what Ale is saying here, you know, Costa Rica is an agricultural economy. This day, if you look at the numbers on the main crops, which are going to be bananas, pineapple, tourism, they continue to be even larger than they were before the reform, but they are now less in proportion in terms of trade. Costa Rica is the number one exporter of pineapples in the world. It is on the top list for coffee and for banana still. But what you observe is that there is this development of other areas that that position the country in a very different situation. It does enjoy some indicators that are, you know, in many cases superior to some developed countries, like longevity, life expectancy for, you know, men and women is higher. A death of children, you know, per under the age of 5 per 1,000 is very low. Levels of education and literacy are very, very high. Access to healthcare. So you have all these indicators that are of the, you know, advanced economies with some problems from developing economies. And so it is, again, it's a very interesting case, and it brings up some very unique statistics that that matter in the understanding of then why still a developing economy.
Yeah, and all of this goes to show why emerging markets was the perfect title for this. It quite literally is an emerging market. Well, before we dive deeper into Costa Rica's, you know, developing economy, the entrepreneurial system, I do want to give this an opportunity to say that we are currently promoting our study abroad program, our J-term program to Costa Rica, where our students have the opportunity to travel there for 2 weeks as a part of our January term in 2025. And so, you know, one of the sayings that we have at this center is we work hard and we play hard. Yes. So this conference with, you know, your academics that were participating, not only were you participating in this research, you know, conference, but you had the opportunity to go to some landmarks and really popular destinations that maybe tourists would be attracted to. So do you want to tell us about how you you played hard after y'all worked hard?
Oh, absolutely. You know, with the group of people that went, total about 12 people, plus you know, local participants, we had the opportunity to visit a few very nice restaurants. So we have a chance to enjoy Costa Rican cuisine, which is a mixture of local ingredients with traditional European cooking style and with substitutions. And so the meals were just amazing. The hotel that we were at is just in the city next to the university, so very nice, quiet place. And then we went and visit in our short period there. We went to Volcán Irazú, which is one of the active volcanoes. It peaks at 3,430 meters above sea level. That's just shy of 12,000 feet. And so it was, oxygen was very low. And I told the people, be careful, don't run. We got a couple people.
It was literally breathtaking in all its significance.
Yeah. So that was incredibly nice. The weather was very good too. We had a nice, nice weather. And in fact, we do not need AC or heating devices. So that was very good. We had a couple of, we have a farewell dinner. It was very nice at a Swiss restaurant in Costa Rica. It was a delicious meal. So we had a chance to experience that. And of course, we also experienced the underdevelopment part of it, right? Traffic congestion and a little bit of a smog here and there. And, we got to see some of the poverty in the streets. But we engaged, in a very nice and well-run experience. I'm also happy to, now that you mention it, of the study abroad, to say that we are promoting Alessandro as the faculty leader for this year of the study abroad in Costa Rica. So we're passing the torch in this regard to give some.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. Farah didn't know.
I did not know. That's news to me.
So, yeah, we're working on that. And so as part of the growth of the programs, right, involving the faculty, and here is something that on the previous podcast we didn't talk about, but I'm going to make the most of this little commercial. The students that come to Loyola College of Business, they encounter the possibility to hear English from a large variety of foreign-born faculty, myself included, Ali included, Professor Massar included, Max Belitsky included. And so they also develop an ear for accents, which is a skill in this business of international business. And consequently, a lot of the faculty that we have are, of course, bilingual, but in many cases, tri- or tetralingual. And, Ali's not going to say it, but I'm going to say it. Ali's trilingual, so he speaks fluent Spanish as well, which is a condition to be a faculty leader in the program. And so we're very happy to have a faculty that is not only academically super qualified, but also have the capability to perform in a multitude of languages. And that's a skill that that we like to encourage our students to do it. And we do it by example. You know, so have the capability to speak multiple languages opens up doors in this business of international business. So yeah, we're very happy about this.
That's so exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. And Gustavo is also too modest to tell us that he's also trilingual because he speaks a very, very nice and good Italian.
Thank you very much, Ali. Thank you. I speak all my languages with an accent now.
And I still only speak English, which should change very soon. But Just a side note, because we know we might have students listening who are interested in our Costa Rica program. Yes. So what better way to hear about the exciting things they could experience on the trip than from the two leaders themselves? Mm-hmm. So just to dive back in, Dr. Barboza, can you talk a little bit about the entrepreneurial system in Costa Rica, as such as the strengths as well as the developing economy?
It's an amazing question. This is an amazing question because, and I'll start with the end of the answer so that we can build around it. We argue that Costa Rica is an emerging economy, but others have argued, predominantly this was brought by Bill Newberry, that Costa Rica, what if Costa Rica is an emerged economy already? It's no longer an emerging economy, it's emerged, but still thinks it is. And if it thinks it is, then it might act as if it is in some dimensions. And so when you start looking at the data and you start breaking it down by sector of economic activity, by type of firm, by employment, then you start getting some very interesting dynamics. And these dynamics speak of the presence of what appears to be a dual economy. And a dual economy is one that faces two different realities. And the realities are either you work for the private sector or you work for the government. If you work for the government, your mentality is very different. Now, understanding what government has to be conceptualized by the place. In the U.S., working for the government means a few agencies. In emerging economies, working for the government may mean that you work for the electrical company, the water company, the insurance company, banking, hospitals, education, and then the government, right? And so you have these issues of seniority and tenure at the government offices, and people do not transition out of those as part of the old, you know, economic model. And then you have the new generation of people that have been educated bilingual. And Costa Rica has about 18% of the population is completely fully bilingual. Others have some percentage of, you know, bilingualism. And then the opportunities then start developing in two different directions. So what we observe in this particular case, as the data is telling us, is that there is these two sides of the economy, one that is very dynamic, driven by foreign direct investment and the spillovers that this foreign direct investment creates to other companies coming in, because if so-and-so is there, then I want to go there, and because so-and-so is there, then I'm going to develop a new company within the country, and or because I work for a multinational, then I spin it off and then create my own company that serves this market, vis-a-vis those that do not transition into that sector of the economy. And then they get left behind or, in a way, have to deal with the second part of the economy. And so you observe that the dynamism of the exporting sector grows fast, low levels of unemployment. You look at the dynamism of, or lack of the other sectors is more unemployment, less growth. You observe differences in wages that are marked. There is a wage premium if you work for the multinationals that is in the range of about 20%. You get paid in U.S. dollars, which is another element of an almost full dollarization of the economy, in which both currencies go back and forth. You observe, for instance, one of the biggest challenges that Costa Rica is facing today is too much money coming in. And the level of foreign currency coming into Costa Rica is record. Tourism, foreign direct investment, to the point that the Costa Rican currency is revaluating itself, and thus Costa Rica is losing competitiveness. Translation, workers are becoming more expensive. The profit margin that firms are going to get is going to be lower, yet firms do not stop coming in. So they're just coming in and storming into the country. And we argue that part of this is because it provides that safety, that closeness to the market, and it provides the security that the products are going to be produced at high quality and coming in. So when you get into these weaknesses and threats, the weakness, it has to create more bilingual population. There was a policy sort of law proposal bill, if you will, to make English mandatory in second official language of the country. That's bold. That may happen. You have still large paper red tape to deal with. Opening up business is not as easy as if, say, you were to do it in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia or Singapore, where it takes you hours to open a business. It's just that simple. Or closing a business. So you have those elements. You have problems with congestion in the city because it's a relatively small area that is highly populated. So you spend a lot of time on the roads. On the flip side, you have excellent connectivity. So you have Costa Rica has 98% of the territory has access to electricity that is clean energy. Costa Rica does not burn oil or coal to generate energy. It's all coming from water and or geothermic. So that's clean energy, which of course serves a lot as a good PR for it. It has, again, good hospital systems, good education, it's peaceful. And so when you look at the ecosystem, one thing that is missing is the connectivity between the training facilities, universities, and high schools with the demands of the most dynamic sector. And so that's a step in which we are trying to help through partnerships, MOUs, in promoting the development of new programs, international business and entrepreneurship being two that we would like to propose. So those are some of the elements within the ecosystem that may be missing. And here the work of Professor Teodoraki at the conference was very important in mentioning, you know, there's these different levels, right, the macro, the meso, and the micro, where you have to look at who is who, how do you create a conversation in which everybody pulls in the same direction. And that's one of the takeaways from the conference, right? Everybody has to work in the same direction. And just to play as a team, not to get, you know, camera time, me, is more like everybody, and so the growth can be repositioned. So, yeah, to summarize, the weaknesses, more need for fully the bilingual education, creation of a mentality of those being trained that being an entrepreneur is okay, that is not something that families do as a family business, but anyone can do it. The threats, of course, too much money coming in could be a problem, and then issues with infrastructure. One of the beauties of democracies is that in order to do something, you have to come to an agreement. But one of the weaknesses of democracies is in order to do something, everybody has to come to an agreement. And those reforms could take, I mean, extended very long periods of time to be approved because of that that beauty of the democracy. So that could be an implicit threat, how to move faster with a demand for new highways, better transportation, better ports, bigger airport, and the list, you know, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, and a big part of what I'm hearing you say is a comment that you love to say, which is location matters. Yeah. And so perspective matters. And these, depending on where your location is, whether you are viewing cases of such as Costa Rica, like we're discussing, whether it is an emerging versus an emerged market, your location matters on which definition you would apply it to, which thus signifies the strengths and weaknesses of Costa Rica. So. All right, so wrap this session up. I would love to ask a final question to you both, which is, what do you both think the contribution of international business studies is in this race to become world players? If you want to start, Dr. Braga.
I guess I start first. I can think of four main elements that I associate with the international business that can be decisive. Revisiting all this that we discussed about Costa Rica, but that can be applied to other locations as well. The first one is overcoming what is called in literature the silo thinking, which is the idea for some of the listeners that might not know the significance of it. Silo thinking means thinking about your organization as something isolated from the rest of the environment. Meaning defining your strategies just based on your micro level. That is something that a country like Costa Rica and something that every business, every manager, every entrepreneur should avoid doing. Acknowledging that we are within ecosystems, like Dr. Barbosa was saying earlier, that the ecosystem either grow together or die together. There is no place for opportunism for an ecosystem to work and to be effective. The second element, which is connected to the first one, is that we need to shift again from considering the stakeholders as part of a network towards considering them as part of an ecosystem again. As I probably mentioned in one of the earliest podcasts, one of the earliest episodes, an ecosystem is much more than a network, because it's something that is living, something in which component can change from one day to another. That means that as entrepreneurs, as business owners, as managers, we need to acknowledge what are the main actors of the ecosystem, what are the actors we should be dealing with, and how we should do it. That is a rule that stands if you are a business owner as much as if you are a policymaker. In fact, one of the weaknesses that I found in Costa Rica, which applies to this debate here, is that still Costa Rica has much untouched potential that is somewhat limited by the sort of dualism between what is called in Spanish the Gran Área Metropolitana, which is basically the metropolitan area, limited also geographically by mountain chain east-west, from what is called the rest of the country, in which we see, it is not something that I just saw in Costa Rica, because I also had experience in teaching courses and visiting other American countries like Peru. It is something that is very common in developing countries, having that much difference in development, in how policies are issued from the city compared to the rest. Overcoming this dualism would mean stepping up the levels of ecosystems. What Gustavo was saying earlier, from micro to meso to macro level, up to what Professor Todoraki explained in the conference, which is building a national level ecosystem, which all the parts of the country are working together and they grow together. Something that very, very few Southern American countries are doing. Because even if we look at Brazil, which is a developing country, Brazil is as probably still one of the most diverse country in terms of income distribution. Very, very rich people, but a huge amount of very poor people, which is the consequence of this type of dualism in setting economic policies. The last two, leadership and ethics. We are business owners. We are managers. We always need to account for how to be leaders that are effective. And we cannot forget how much ethics is important today. Not just because the market calls for us to be ethical, not just because customers now look for ethical business and prefer to deal business with them, but because ethics also implies that we have safety for workers, that we don't exploit the factors of production. The last thing, which is also connected to the previous point, is we also need to look for the sustainability, whether we are talking about policies, whether we are talking about business strategies. What is the contribution that we can do to the environment? What is the contribution that we can do, not just for the environment, but for supporting or for overcoming specific social issues? And so we need to look, not just look, we need to engage actively with social development goals.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ali. Those are spot-on elements to consider as to why it's important, right, to become a world player through international business. I'm not going to repeat what you said. I mean, you said it perfectly. So I'm going to take a little bit of a different spin on it and talk a little bit about you don't have to reinvent the wheel always. You just have to know whether you can buy it or, reuse it in a different way. And because we started talking about spillovers, the basic assumption at the beginning of the conversation was that, and again, this is a controversial topic. It can go either way. I want to take the positive side and explain the negative side, just briefly. The assumption is that companies that come from abroad come with superior technology. And if this technology is superior to whatever the emerging markets might have, the potential for a spillover is there. And to capture that spillover and be able to adapt and absorb and use, in other words, commercialize part of this spillover, if you have an international business education, we believe you are much better positioned to understand and connect and use that as a platform to spur growth. The scenario will be not having it, and if you don't have it, you don't welcome it, then you have to generate it domestically. In that generation of the domestic is where emerging markets may lag. And they may lag because they just don't have it. The resources are not there. So becoming a world player matters in the sense of capturing what others have done and then reinventing and making it better. And again, the assumption is multinationals or firms come with knowledge that they, even if they don't want to share, they share. The negative side of it has been these arguments that multinationals only want to exploit, and Alessandro mentioned this, the differences in create this dependency. And this was the school of thought of the 1950s, the dependency theory in which anything foreign is bad. And we still see some of that out there, and we still have to fight. And I guess in some cases it's true, in which firms only want to exploit in that type of foreign direct investment you do not want. That type of money you do not want. Same goes with money that comes from obscure businesses, drug dealing, and what have you. You don't want any of that money. You want to be transparent. You want to follow ethical practices in which you can go back and say the money that came under this, and these are the metrics that we're using. And so a selection process of not falling desperate of money's coming, I'll take it, and vis-a-vis creating a labor force that is well-educated, I think it's essential. Education is a human right. We should all have the opportunity to be educated. And if we are, then why not go and be international citizens? Yes, you act locally, you live in a country, but with the perspective that there is so much to learn from others. And consequently, I think that's where international business comes into play. In at least that's what we're pushing here, and we believe on it, and we're a little bit biased, but that's okay. Right? And so, yes, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. I think this was such a fruitful episode of, really bringing together the three pillars of the College of Business, which is ethics, entrepreneurship, and international business. And these key topics of international business, of knowledge spillover effects and foreign direct investment, diving into these topics is just so essential to anyone wanting to establish themselves in the field, students who are pursuing the field of international business, and professionals that are already there. So thank you both so much for being here and for talking about your experience. And we hope to, obviously we'll have you back again, but thank you guys. And you can subscribe to this podcast. And if you have any more interesting questions, comments, concerns, you can find us at cib.loino.edu. You can connect with all of us on LinkedIn and follow our page on LinkedIn, which is Center for International Business, Loyola University, New Orleans. So we will catch you guys next time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Gumbo of Opportunities, the podcast about international business of Southern Louisiana and New Orleans. Huge thanks to Farah, Oban, and all the staff involved for making this podcast possible. The music is New Orleans Jazz Guitar Music by The Music Hive.